Chapter 41, The Death of Elder James White. Notwithstanding the labors, cares, and responsibilities with which my husband's life had been crowded, his 60th year found him active and vigorous in mind and body. Three times he had fallen under a stroke of paralysis, yet by the blessing of God, a naturally strong constitution, and strict attention to the laws of health, he had been unable to rally. Again, he traveled, preached, and wrote with his wonted zeal and energy. Side by side, we had labored in the cause of Christ for 35 years, and we hoped that we might stand together to witness the triumphant close. But such was not the will of God. The chosen protector of my youth, the companion of my life, the share of my labors and afflictions was taken from my side, and I was left to finish my work and to fight the battle alone. In the spring and early summer of 1881, we spent together at our home in Battle Creek. My husband hoped to arrange his business so that we could go to the Pacific Coast and devote ourselves to writing. He felt that we had made a mistake in allowing the apparent wants of the cause and the entreaties of our brethren to urge us into active labor and preaching when we should have been writing. My husband desired to present more fully the glorious subject of redemption, and I had long contemplated the preparation of important books. We both felt that while our mental powers were unimpaired, we should complete these works, that it was a duty which we owed to ourselves and to the cause of God to rest from the heat of battle and give to our people the precious light of truth which God had opened to our minds. Some weeks before the death of my husband, I urged upon him the importance of seeking a field of labor where we would be released from the burdens necessarily coming upon us at Battle Creek. In reply, he spoke of various matters which required attention before we could leave, duties which someone must do. Then with deep feeling he inquired, "Where are the men to do this work? Where are those who will have an unselfish interest in our institutions and who will stand for the right unaffected by any influence with which they may come in contact?" With tears he expressed his anxiety for our institutions at Battle Creek. Said he, "My life has been given to the upbuilding of these institutions. It seems like death to leave them. They are as my children, and I cannot separate my interests from them. These institutions are the Lord's instrumentalities to do a specific work. Satan seeks to hinder and defeat every means by which the Lord is working for the salvation of men. If the great adversary can mold these institutions according to the world's standard, his object is gained. It is my greatest anxiety to have the right man in the right place. If those who stand in responsible positions are weak in moral power and vacillating in principle, inclined to lead toward the world, there are enough who will be led. Evil influences must not prevail. I would rather die than live to see these institutions mismanaged or turned aside from the purpose for which they were brought into existence. In my relations to this cause, I have been longest and most closely connected with the publishing work. Three times have I fallen stricken with paralysis through my devotion to this branch of the cause. Now that God has given me renewed physical and mental strength, I feel that I can serve His cause as I have never been able to serve it before. I must see the publishing work prosper. It is interwoven with my very existence. If I forget the interest of this work, let my right hand forget her cunning." We had an appointment to attend a tent meeting at Charlotte, Sabbath and Sunday, July 23 and 24. We decided to travel by private conveyance. On the way, my husband seemed cheerful, yet a feeling of solemnity rested upon him. He repeatedly praised the Lord for His mercies and blessings received, and freely expressed his own feelings concerning the past and future. "The Lord is good and greatly to be praised. He is a present help in time of need. The future seems cloudy and uncertain, but the Lord would not have us distressed over these things. When trouble comes, He has given us grace to endure it. What the Lord has been to us and what He has done for us should make us so grateful that we would never murmur or complain. It has seemed hard to me that my motives should be misjudged and that my best efforts to help, encourage, and strengthen my brethren should again and again be turned against me. But I should have remembered Jesus and His disappointments. His soul was grieved that He was not appreciated by those He came to bless. I should have dwelt upon the mercy and loving kindness of God, praising Him more and complaining less of the ingratitude of my brethren. Had I ever left all my perplexities with the Lord, thinking less of what others said and did against me, I should have had more peace and joy. I will now seek first to guard myself that I offend not in word or deed, and then to help my brethren to make straight paths for their feet. I will not stop to mourn over any wrong done to me. I have expected more of men than I ought. I love God and His work, and I love my brethren also. Little did I think as we traveled on that this was the last journey we should ever make together. The weather changed suddenly from oppressive heat to chilling cold. My husband took cold, but thought his health so good that he would receive no permanent injury. He labored in the meetings at Charlotte, presenting the truth with great clearness and power. He spoke of the pleasure he felt in addressing the people who manifested so deep an interest in the subjects most dear to him. The Lord has indeed refreshed my soul, he said, while I have been breaking to others the bread of life. All over Michigan, the people are calling eagerly for help. How I long to comfort, encourage, and strengthen them with the precious truths applicable to this time. On our return home, my husband complained of slight indisposition, yet he engaged in his work as usual. Every morning we visited the grove near our home and united in prayer. We were anxious to know our duty. Letters were continually coming in from different places urging us to attend the camp meetings. Notwithstanding our determination to devote ourselves to writing, it was hard to refuse to meet with our brethren in these important gatherings. We earnestly pleaded for wisdom to know the right course. Sabbath morning, as usual, we went to the grove together, and my husband prayed most fervently three times. He seemed reluctant to cease pleading with God for special guidance and blessing. His prayers were heard, and peace and light came to our hearts. He praised the Lord and said, "Now I give it all up to Jesus. I feel a sweet heavenly peace and assurance that the Lord will show us our duty, for we desire to do His will." He accompanied me to the tabernacle and opened the service with singing. It was the last time he was ever to stand by my side in the pulpit. On the following morning, he had a severe chill, and the next day I too was attacked. Together we were taken to the sanitarium for treatment. On Friday, my symptoms became more favorable. The doctor then informed me that my husband was inclined to sleep and the danger was apprehended. I was immediately taken to his room, and as soon as I looked upon his countenance, I knew that he was dying. I tried to arouse him. He understood all that was said to him and responded to all questions that could be answered by yes or no, but seemed unable to say more. When I told him I thought he was dying, he manifested no surprise. I asked if Jesus was precious to him. He said, "Yes, oh yes." "Have you no desire to live?" I inquired. He answered, "No." We then knelt by his bedside, and I prayed for him. A peaceful expression rested upon his countenance. I said to him, "Jesus loves you. The everlasting arms are beneath you." He responded, "Yes, yes." Brother Smith and our brethren then prayed around his bedside and returned to spend much of the night in prayer. My husband said he felt no pain, but he was evidently failing fast. Dr. Kellogg and his helpers did all that was in their power to hold him back from death. He slowly revived, but continued very weak. The next morning he seemed slightly to revive, but about noon he had a chill which left him unconscious. At 5 p.m. Sabbath, August 6, 1881, he quietly breathed his life away without a struggle or a groan. The shock of my husband's death, so sudden, so unexpected, fell upon me with crushing weight. In my feeble condition, I had summoned strength to remain at his bedside to the last. But when I saw his eyes closed in death, exhausted nature gave way and I was completely prostrated. For some time, I seemed balancing between life and death. The vital flame burned so low that a breath might extinguish it. At night my pulse would grow feeble and my breathing fainter and fainter until it seemed about to cease. Only by the blessing of God and the unremitting care and watchfulness of physician and attendants was my life preserved. Though I had not risen from my sickbed after my husband's death, I was borne to the tabernacle on the following Sabbath to attend his funeral. At the close of the sermon, I felt it a duty to testify to the value of the Christian's hope in the hour of sorrow and bereavement. As I arose, strength was given me, and I spoke about 10 minutes, exalting the mercy and love of God in the presence of that crowded assembly. At the close of the services, I followed my husband to Oak Hill Cemetery, where he was laid to rest until the morning of the resurrection. My physical strength had been prostrated by the blow, yet the power of divine grace sustained me in my great bereavement. When I saw my husband breathe his last, I felt that Jesus was more precious to me than ever he had been in any previous hour of my life. When I stood by my firstborn and closed his eyes in death, I could say, "The Lord gave and the Lord taketh away. Blessed be the name of the Lord." And I felt then that I had a comforter in Jesus. And when my latest born was torn from my arms and I could no longer see its little head upon the pillow by my side, then I could say, "The Lord gave and the Lord hath taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord." And when he upon whose large affections I had leaned, with whom I had labored for 35 years, was taken away, I could lay my hands upon his eyes and say, "I commit my treasure to thee till the morning of the resurrection." When I saw him passing away and saw the many friends sympathizing with me, I thought, what a contrast to the death of Jesus as he hung upon the cross. What a contrast. In the hour of his agony, the revilers were mocking and deriding him. But he died, and he passed through the tomb to brighten it, to lighten it, that we might have joy and hope even in the event of death, that we might say, as we lay our friends away to rest in Jesus, we shall meet them again. At times I felt I could not have my husband die, but these words seemed to be impressed on my mind, "Be still and know that I am God." Psalm 40, verse 10, 46, verse 10. I keenly feel my loss, but dare not give myself up to useless grief. This would not bring back the dead, and I am not so selfish as to wish, if I could, to bring him from his peaceful slumber to engage again in the battles of life. Like a tired warrior, he has lain down to sleep. I will look with pleasure upon his resting place. The best way in which I and my children can honor the memory of him who has fallen is to take the work where he left it, and in the strength of Jesus, carry it forward to completion. We will be thankful for the years of usefulness that were granted to him, and for his sake and for Christ's sake, we shall learn from his death a lesson which we shall never forget. We will let this bereavement make us more kind and gentle, more forbearing, patient, and thoughtful toward the living. I take up my life work alone in full confidence that my Redeemer will be with me. We have only a little while to wage the warfare, then Christ will come, and this scene of conflict will close. Then our last efforts will have been made to work with Christ and advance His kingdom. Some who have stood in the forefront of the battle, zealously resisting incoming evil, fall at the post of duty. The living gaze sorrowfully at the fallen heroes, but there is no time to cease work. We must close up the ranks, seize the banner from the hand palsied by death, and with renewed energy vindicate the truth and the honor of Christ. As never before, resistance must be made against sin, against the powers of darkness. The time demands energetic and determined activity on the part of those who believe present truth. If the time seems long to wait for our deliverer to come, if bowed by affliction and worn with toil, we feel impatient to receive an honorable release from the warfare, let us remember, and let the remembrance check every murmur, that we are left on earth to encounter storms and conflicts, to perfect Christian character, to become better acquainted with God our Father and with Christ our elder brother, and to do work for the Master in winning souls to Christ. They that be wise shall shine as the brightness of the firmament, and they that turn many to righteousness as the stars forever and ever. Daniel 12:3.